Fair Food Forager.
Changing the way the world eats
by making ethical easy.
That sounds like a very good idea.
Fair Food Forager.
This podcast is brought to you by the Fair Food Forager app. It's the world's most comprehensive sustainable food directory, and it's in about 25 countries now with about 6,500 venues, anywhere where you can get good, healthy, sustainable food. And it also has its own social media, so I'd love to see you there. Don't forget to download the Fair Food Forager app. Today is a much-awaited podcast with former Greens Senator Bob Brown. I actually meant to go down to Tasmania and try to do this one in person, but because of COVID, it had to be done online. And you'll see at the end, at about 5 minutes to go, it ends fairly abruptly because Bob had to go to another interview and take care of some more environmental matters. He's such a legend, and if you ever listen to Bob speak, you'll know why I really wanted to interview him. It would be great if we had more politicians like this. And Bob's also a former doctor as well. This guy's a pretty intelligent bloke, so I hope you enjoy this podcast. Here is Bob Brown.
Well, thanks very much for being on the podcast. Pretty excited to have the Bob Brown on the Fair Food Forager and Friends show.
I'm just mate.
And how are you handling all this pandemic stuff? Have you been enjoying a bit of time at home? And
been very busy with environmental issues, including the current one of gutting what little environmental laws we got. But yes, very pleased to be not travelling, except around Tasmania.
Yes, and what are you concentrating on at the moment environmentally?
The planet.
The planet, yes. Yes, that's a good one.
If you take your mind off that, you get lost in the interstices. But the planet is in a dire environmental strife due to our human impact, and it's rapidly getting worse. And the signs are clear, and I've seen this in so many other parallel histories, that it will go to a point of disastrous consequences before we wealthy human beings will react to it.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's quite easy for a lot of people to just think that it's sometime in the future and it's not affecting them now, so we'll just worry about it later on.
Oh, for the federal elections last year in April 2019, 90% of Australians voted for more coal mines, more coal steam gas extraction, oil wells in the Great Australian Bight, and logging and burning of forests and woodlands and rare and endangered species habitat right around the country. So, you know, we've got a lot of lip service to the environment, but when it gets down to even such a simple thing as what you vote for, money for the individual gets a high priority over the future well-being of life on the planet, including the children who are now in primary schools who are going to face disastrous consequences from climate change, let alone all the other things that we have to contend with.
Yeah, it's one thing that I'm often perplexed about is that issue of people with children and grandchildren, and as you say, still voting for franking credits, which in the scheme of, as you say, the planet, aren't much.
Well, it's a little bit to do with Mother Nature's fault, because it built into us a self-preservation instinct which said, look after yourself, everything else will fall into place, including for your children. And if you're going to make a better life for them, then get more goods and more money yourself. And that instinct for more stuff overrides our intellectual ability, and it's a bit discomforting to think, oh, we've got to pull our belts in if we're going to survive on a planet in which human beings are using nearly double the replaceable living renewable resources, so that every day we wake up to fewer forests, fewer species, fewer fisheries, more destroyed coral, less arable land, more mouths to feed, and a urgent pursuit of extracting those resources even faster, even though we're now living beyond the planet's ability to replace them, in the pursuit of growth economics. And it's a religion. It's got the world by the throat, and it will take some very big events to alter that. And history's full of how people will fight for religious belief and fight to the death if necessary to keep it going, and don't want to be discomforted by changing to something that's more sensible or rational or reasonable or even kinder to other people. One of the great mysteries to me is how readily we've dropped what the old great religions had as their central tenet, which was the golden rule: do unto others as you'd have them do unto yourself. That's out the window. Modern materialism doesn't allow for that one at all. And we've got the major parties in Australia. You'll never hear them come up with that, but all in favour of growth economics, extracting more from a planet that's able to provide less, and which in my lifetime has seen population growth go from two and population on the planet of people go from 2.5 billion to now, within the next couple of years, 8 billion. That's more than tripling in my own lifetime. And that's, you know, you see all sorts of projections into the future, but that's not going to level off before 10, 11 or 12 billion. And with a massive proportionate increase in wealth demanded by all of those people, not least the wealthy. So it's absurd, it's silly, it's stupid, but the majority of people on Earth are pursuing more goods, and certainly the wealthy few who own the majority of resources are not about to pull their belts in and say, let's share this, which is the obvious thing we should be doing.
Yeah, and I think... I think you mentioned there it's a bit of a sickness, isn't it, when you're worth billions of dollars and you're willing to destroy the planet or destroy other people so you can make another billion or 2 billion. It's almost a mental health issue for some of those people. They can't even spend the money even if they tried, but they just want more because of an ego.
I don't think it's a mental health issue. I think it really is just their own instincts playing out and their weakness of ability to say intellectually what's obvious to them. I've got to turn this around, and that responsibility is on me as much as any other person. And, you know, in comes then the tribal instinct to protect what we've got, the fellows in our group, and the fear that people have of stepping out of that and saying, well, I'm not going to continue doing this for one. But there you go. I'm very happy, in amongst all that, to be an environmentalist and to be working with a foundation that's action-oriented to saving the planet. And that means this remarkable intellectual species, Homo sapiens, on the planet. And our motto is... don't get depressed, get active. And if you do have a good brain on you, and we all do, we all at least think we do, then it is logical to get depressed about what's happening on the planet. But it just knocks you out of action. And it's much better, kinder to self, to become active and to employ an optimistic view that altogether, left to our own reasonable, we could make it. There's no one I don't sit down with who doesn't want to have a viable, livable, happy planet, country, district for their children to enjoy into the future. But ensuring that's going to happen is a different thing.
Yeah. I think you're right. If we're all having this people who are, you know, out there being active and trying to do, whether it's at a local level or a state or a national level, go through these moments where they're 1 minute sort of depressed about the way globally things look, but then trying to be optimistic and you know, celebrating some small wins that we have. How do you keep yourself positive and upbeat and keep going? Is it just because there is no other option?
That's right. It's empirical. Mm. We don't have an option. But I keep saying, if you're going to open a sandwich shop and you're going to make a success of it, be optimistic. If you're on the other side of the counter to customers saying how bad things are and you don't know whether you'll make it and life is tough, you'll find they won't come back again. And optimism and a healthy, cheery attitude towards the future in whatever pursuit it is pays great dividends. And if you look at the great movements that have changed history from abolition of slavery to the suffragettes and many other things, they didn't get there through thinking they were going to fail. They got there through a belief that they would succeed. And at the moment, this whole planet is in the same boat. We are a single human community and we either sink or swim together. And that's not understood by the chest-thumping President Xi in China or President Trump in America or our own Scott Morrison or whoever it is around the planet. Most leaders do not understand that fostering self-interest and tribalism is a recipe for a very big breakdown in the human society as we go down the line. That's why I'm an advocate of global governance. I hope nobody in the Murdoch media hears this interview, Paul, because they go ape about it, because Rupert Murdoch is one of the very, very wealthy, powerful people on this planet who runs it at the moment in the absence of global government. And influences where governments go and what they do and how they feel and who gets elected and who doesn't. And woe betide anybody who comes along and says, well, let's have a global democracy, one person, one vote, one value for one planet. And indeed, when I moved that in the Senate back in 2003, everybody in the Senate except the Greens voted against having a global parliament just to look at international issues. Issues, not to interfere in national issues, but such things as nuclear weapons, plagues like we're having at the moment, international monetary transfers, a Tobin tax there would raise enough money to get everybody who's in extreme poverty out of it. And, of course, the environmental commons of the oceans and so on, it's been left to people like Sea Shepherd to defend the oceans, the creatures of the oceans, against sectional interests all wanting to come in and plunder it. And, of course, the oceans are doing very badly. We should have an international environmental authority with an international police force. And just as we're doing this interview, of course, the Samuel interim report of Graeme Samuels to Environment Minister Susan Ley recommends just that, that there are standards that are set and then a police force to ensure that they're upkept, with obviously penalties to pay. And immediately the minister, and that means the prime minister of course as well, have said, oh no, we'll work for some standards, but we prohibit the idea that there should be any policing of those standards. In other words, we will have no environmental laws with teeth in them. We're removing the teeth. That's the situation internationally. It's the situation nationally, even though it's common sense that it's the environment that matters. A healthy economy just totally depends on a healthy ecological system. And if you have a breakdown of the environment, and we're seeing that to some small degree with COVID-19, then you have a breakdown in economic well-being. And when Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid, he got one word wrong. It's the environment, stupid. That's what matters on this planet. And until we get that and understand that and implement it and make it, and until the Minister for the Environment's more powerful than the Treasurer of the day, we haven't got it right.
Mm. And do you think things like the pandemic will potentially, maybe not with this government, but have some sort of an impact where this type of setup could possibly happen into the future? Is this, do you know if this is something that the current Greens party are looking at bringing forward again, or is it just a would fall on deaf ears at the moment?
No, well, look at the Greens are it's basically an ecology party, and yet only 10% of the electorate gives their vote to the Greens. The Greens, of course, are very strong on social justice, peace and democracy as well.
Mm.
But, we'll see that change, and we are seeing a rapid growth in the Greens votes, for example, in recent elections in France and Germany. And I expect we'll see that elsewhere, but it's the pity of it is it takes increasing breakdown of social and environmental and indeed economic systems before people will empower others with a longer term vision. So it's very hard to tell there whether disaster comes before reform or reform comes before a disaster. It appears like we're too comfortable. And J.K. Galbraith, the great American economist, wrote his book, The Culture of Contentment, in the 1990s. I recommend it to everybody. But it's about how humanity has serially allowed itself to drift into absurd situations, economic and otherwise, and then had to come to a shuddering Great Depression or whatever it might be, and a reform to get it out of that. But it's now not a national dilemma that we face, but a global one. And there is very, very little evidence of either voters or politicians or corporate heads or media scribes and editors wanting global governance and the empowerment of 8 billion people together to chart our common direction into the future. In fact, there's greater and greater emphasis on the local, and we're seeing President Xi in China, for example, now with his ambassadors around the world threatening people and saying he's going to the South China Seas are theirs and the Belt and Road, and repeating the imperialism that we've seen with America and Britain and so on back in the past. But when it comes down to it, even China's only got 20% of the world's population. And it is as much as anybody reliant on the rest of the world for its future sustenance and well-being. But we're not going to see that assert itself until we get democracy in China. And, of course, that's being very brutally repressed, as you can see with the Uyghurs and the Tibetans, and let alone the democracy movement per se, and, of course, Hong Kong at the moment. But as far as Australia's attitude towards that ruthless policy coming out of the Communist Party in Beijing, it's obsequiousness because trade is too important for us to get in the way. And, you know, there are moves by government to be a little bit tougher because things look a bit desperate at the moment. Mm. But Australia is a middle order country, ought to be totally independent, whether it be of China or of America or indeed Britain, and trying to get together a new global polity in which we all recognise we've got to give a little to make this planet more secure into the future. And if we've got three different countries, as we have at the moment, sending spaceships to Mars, surely we can and get the same groups of powerful countries together to chart a peaceful and sustainable future here on planet Earth.
Mm. And you can see now with the pandemic that it would be the perfect time to start from scratch and start, you know, looking at the environment and trying to rebuild something that is good for the planet and good for us rather than fighting against it all the time. At least the planet has had a bit of a break from some of the activities.
Yes, but you see, and America's played this out very strongly, the economy even before the health of the peoples, and we're seeing hundreds of thousands of people dying in America who should not have died because the incumbent president and his acolytes have put the value of money ahead of the value of human happiness even. And why should we think that that's going to change anytime soon? And what I see at this stage with the pandemic is that everywhere the economic considerations are to the fore and the environmental ones are taking a back seat, as we're seeing with this rapid readjustment of environmental law in Australia to hand it basically down to state governments where, for example, in my home state of Tasmania and, of course, several other states, Clearfell logging is an outcome of John Howard handing away environmental control to the loggers of Tasmania via their Labor or Liberal governance at the time. Even with the police force, the Forest Practices Authorities, they're ticking off on all the burning and destruction of forests with the rare and wild rare and endangered wildlife within them. And this has all come down under a law enabling, making sure that it happens and that real environmental considerations didn't get in the way. And the absurdity of all that is that Tasmanians and other Australian taxpayers have paid $2 billion over the last three decades to sustain this logging. In other words, it's depended on taxpayer payments, which should have gone to schools and hospitals and the environment, and people keep voting for it, and not the Greens, who've said, let's stop this. Let's put that money into schools, hospitals, transport, and indeed a better parks, wildlife protection system so that our children inherit the environmental wealth that we've got at the moment. So there you go. I hear a lot of criticism of politicians, but the old adage is true. They're there because we vote for them. And the populace itself has got its priorities wrong. And the environment is way down the pole. And the thing you referred to, the franking credits or whatever, hanging on to those, more money for ourselves in our own time is what prevails.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to talk some more about this forestry thing because I don't think it's common knowledge exactly what's going on. But just before I do.
Oh, it is. It is, Paul. Australians know about it. They've known about it for decades now. In fact, polls show that 70-80% of Australians would like it stopped, but not at any discomfort. And so when it comes to voting, that same 70 or 80%, the great majority of them, vote for more logging and more public subsidies for logging. That's the simple way in which democracy plays out.
Mm.
It's not the politicians. It's the people who vote for the politicians who, in turn, do what the corporate sector wants in that section of the corporate sector that's making money out of destroying valuable environmental amenity that belongs to the public.
Yeah. And do you think a lot of this is coming from because of the media, making people afraid that they're going to lose everything if they vote for the Greens? Because I know, you know, in New South Wales, for example, the Daily Telegraph is pretty much just it's like a Liberal Party brochure, just always making people, it reads like you've got to be fearful if you vote for the Greens. But for the people that I know in the Greens, they're actually, you know, have much more talent in more areas than the environment as well. So it's
I spoke to both Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard about feeding daily stories to the Murdoch media and said, why do you do it? And they basically were concerned that if they didn't, they'd get bad press. And I said, no, they're going to try and get rid of you anyway, which is how it turned out.
Mm.
And it's interesting to see Kevin Rudd now running a very well thought out condemnation of the way the Murdoch media works and its influence. And, you know, you see that in the Daily Telegraph writ large, which is repeatedly having to run columns about how the Press Council is adjudicated against it because it's broken the journalist code of ethics. But down there at Murdoch headquarters, the Australian Code of Journalist Ethics is written up, torn up long ago, and they've written up their own rules, which is do as you want to. And we see they're not newspapers anymore, they're newspapers. But that comes down again to the rule of law. And if you're going to allow the media to not safeguard the public right to the truth or the public right to at least a fair dealing, you know, the simple old rule, if you're going to condemn somebody in a news column, ring them and get their point of view.
Mm.
That routinely is out the window these days. And I think if the government, as it should, were to implement by law the Australian Journalist Code of Ethics, you'd find the Australian media up in arms about it. You know, they've got their own code of ethics, but, and, you know, there's great exceptions to this rule. There are very fine journalists, but they have a harder time getting a job than the hacks who want to really support the vested wealth interests of Rupert Murdoch and such thinkers. At the, you know, and he's a fellow, who, an Australian, who sold out his citizenship to make more money by becoming an American, telling us who stay loyal to our Australian community what we should be doing every day of the week. And we have everybody from prime ministers down tugging their forelock to this curmudgeon of a man who has done so much to make life harder for average Australians and average people around the world. But there you go. yes, the media rules, and it has a big responsibility on its shoulders. And one hopes that the other thing we'll see improving after this little dark age we've had with the media is a more comprehensive and responsible reporting of what happens into the future, because that's much in the hands of social media these days. Mm. And the jury is way out on that one.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, there are definitely positives in people being able to tell the story themselves, and there's all these, you know, and groups like the Bob Brown Foundation get to tell a story and get it out onto people's mobile phones and laptops, so we don't just have to wait for what the Daily Telegraph or Channel 9 is going to tell us anymore. We can get alternative views, and hopefully more and more people are tuning into those.
Yes, or even the ABC, which, you know, has had to move to the right to accommodate condemnation and government threats and monetary cutbacks. That's where we are in Australia in 2020. But we're all potential activists. It depends on how many people become active for a more progressive future and a more enlightened one, and supporting the media outlets that have a more reasoned approach to the future of this country and the planet. And that means its environment as well. As its society, it really depends on how active we become. And there's not great signs of the great Australian apathy and inertia lifting at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about, say, the forestry, people are, you know, as we mentioned, very interested in their own superannuation or you know, their own income. And the Daily Telegraph will talk about, you know, the dole bludger and put all the emphasis on people who are getting, you know, a couple of $100 a week. But then they're okay with forestry companies cutting down our forests and being subsidised by the government. And that's the link that I don't understand.
Well, they're not only okay with that, but when it comes to bludging, the editor of the Daily Telegraph has more tax deductibility than that great number of people who are living below the poverty line or who are on medium incomes in Australia. But you won't find a freedom of information system that allows you to discover what the editor and senior staff people at the Telegraph are A, getting, because it all comes out of the public purse, the buying of newspapers and the paying for advertising is a cost on every single member of the public, just the same as taxes are. So here we have limpets on the public who know every trick in the book to make themselves wealthier at the expense of average Australians. And get away with it. Now, that said, of course they're going to support the people that they have dinner with in the National Association for Logging or Mining or Big Business, whatever it might be, in keeping the rorting going, which means that the big end of town lives in great luxury while, for example, First Australians, by and large, live in poverty, and that's the way they want to keep it. And if you move to change the power system to give those people who, for example, First Australians, a fair go, you'll find a very quick reaction from the big end of town. We've seen that repeatedly in preventing a treaty with First Australians, in preventing environmental laws that would protect, as New Zealand did 20 years ago, what's left of our native forests and woodlands, as you would do if you valued the Great Barrier Reef, for example, and knew that, as we all do, and as the editor of the Telegraph and the Australian and the Courier Mail and the Herald Sun know, is dying because we're burning fossil fuels. They're promoting us burning more fossil fuels, not fewer. And, you know, history will judge them badly for that, but you don't have them thinking too much about history when they've got themselves to think about first.
It's obviously very short term, but because I would think globally in the next decade or so, fossil fuels, they're not going to be able to sell the coal that they're trying to dig out of the ground now. You would think that most vehicles are going to be electric or hydrogen in the next decade or so as well. You probably won't even be able to buy a petrol car. So something like Adani is just, it blows my mind where is the thinking behind this? Is someone just getting a quick payoff and then they're not worried about what happens in 10 years' time? Well,
I can tell, Paul, that you don't subscribe to the Courier Mail.
No, I definitely don't.
You know, there's the answer. It writes the most appalling opinions as news. In fact, we had an opinion story in the Courier Mail a year or two ago saying that the black-throated finch, which every reasonable person knows is threatened with extinction and the scientists tell us so, by the Adani coal mine. The Courier Mail running a story by a senior staff member that the only way to save the black-throated finch was to have the mine. And, you know, the contorted logic that came out of that doesn't matter too much. But that's the absurdity of a free press that's been taken over by the plutocracy, by the very rich and wealthy. And, of course, Adani, and you've got people like Senator Kavanaugh saying, well, you know, the barrier reef's 350 kilometres away from the mine, so what are you on about? And they all know what we're on about. They all know the logic of this. But that's good enough to have most people feel like safely they can vote for the Nationals or the Liberals or Clive Palmer or Pauline Hanson, whoever it might be, again. And thumbing the nose at the evidence before one's face that we're being imperiled by what we do is time on it. Neville Chamberlain exemplified that in 1937 when he flew home waving his sheet of paper saying, peace in our time, having signed an agreement with Hitler. And 18 months later, and you know, at the time, a million people danced in the streets of London and all the church bells rang. Well, 18 months later, they were at war because they didn't have a sensible appraisal of what Hitler meant to the future of the planet. History's full of such stories of mass myopia, if you like, but it's never so bad as when it's led by media moguls like Rupert Murdoch and the future of the planet being denied. And the logic of what's happening with the Great Barrier Reef or with the extinction of species generally being denied, and the people who ring the bell have become vilified because the aim of the wise use movement, which came out of America and is now translated and writ large in Murdoch's papers, is to say we can't win an argument about the environment because people are too concerned about it. They'll be on side of the environmentalists. We therefore must vilify and take out the environmentalists. And you'll see increasing attacks, for example, on our foundation about tax deductibility coming. It's coming from a range of state and federal Liberal parliamentarians, and Labor's quiet on the matter because they cannot believe that so many people want to donate towards helping protect the Tarkine rainforest or the habitat of the swift parrot in southern Tasmania or even the Great Barrier Reef through opposition to the Adani mine, let alone the rights of the Indigenous people to their land. And so we've got this extraordinary situation now in Queensland where a Labor government backed by a Murdoch media has given power over the land of Adrian Burugaba and his people, time-honoured people who occupied the land long before Adani got there, having to ask Mr. Adani if they can go on to his land that's been transferred to him to exploit and destroy. So, most Queenslanders will not vote for the Greens at the upcoming election in October, although I think we will see an increased vote because things have become so patently absurd, if not desperate.
Mm.
We'll vote for the big parties or the right-wing smaller entities and for more coal mining and for more public subsidising of people like Adani. And one of the things that struck me very much about this, there's another billionaire, this one pulling the strings on what happens in central Queensland from New Delhi. But go up there with a convoy of people from around Australia, Australian citizens, as we did last year, and you'll find the whole world comes down, led by the Murdoch media, on outside interference. It's okay for Adani, friend of Modi, the Prime Minister of India, to be displacing Indigenous people over there to build a power station, to burn coal from displaced Indigenous people here in Australia. But don't mention us. Don't mention that. Just get stuck into environmentalists who simply want to say this is wrong, this shouldn't be happening, where there are better alternatives for Australia, and get stuck into them as individuals. You know, don't take on the argument because they know they'll lose the argument. So vilify the people, and we see that as a regular routine in the Murdoch media, is vilifying good people, whether they be in the legal or teaching or Indigenous or environmental or other progressive community sectors in Australia. Take the people out. Let's not try to take on the argument because we'll lose.
Mm. Yeah, that you mentioned a good point there, that at the last federal election, that was one of the things that I was banging on about to everyone who would listen to me, because refugees was seemed to be such a polarizing issue, where people didn't want to help people from foreign countries who were fleeing persecution, but they seemed okay to vote for a government that was going to support an Indian billionaire to set up a coal mine and potentially destroy the livelihood of people that rely on the reef as well.
Well, most people who are concerned and alarmed about the situation, that appalling situation on Manus Island and Nauru, have voted Labor or Liberal or National Party, the very people who have implemented that system. You know, there you go.
Yeah.
That's the frailty and fragility of individuals as well as communities as a whole, writ large, in the outcome of democratic processes. I've got this this environmental issue to address of this legislation that's coming down the line now in August, according to Environmental Minister Susan Lee. Before the Graham Samuel report on what we should be doing comes out some months later, if we get caught in the process, as they want us to, of discussing what standards we should have, having her declare at day one that Samuel's call for a COP, he used that word, to police environmental standards. She said, no, we're not going to have that. We'll have the standards, but we won't have the police. My great alarm here is that many people, including environmentalists, will get sucked into the ongoing process rather than opposing it, because Prime Minister Morrison and Environment Minister Lee know exactly what their outcome is going to be. It's going to be to strip what little environmental protection, or at least analysis of the destructiveness of many proposals that get rich people want to have. They want to get rid of so-called green tape. That means sensible environmental processes. And yesterday, the Minister for the Environment sold the environment out comprehensively in saying, no, we're not going to have that recommended policing of environmental laws. You know, we've got them for a whole range of crimes under the Crimes Act. That's why we have police and a court system. We've got it through corporate regulation. You may argue that it's not very strong, but we have the ACCC, from which Graham Samuel came, who's doing this inquiry. But we're not to have it for the environment, because plundering the environment is making some people rich. And that's what Scott Morrison and that's what Susan Lee are in favour of, keeping that going at the expense of the public, and in particular at the expense of people who come after us and our fellow creatures in this country and on this planet.
Mm. You yourself, you had, a pretty huge, you were involved in a big environment win with the Franklin Dam quite many decades ago. What can people like myself and those listening to this podcast do now? If we're up against things like that where they just don't want environmental protection, what would you
do? Get active. Get active and be defiant. And, you know, you have to risk personal comfort about it. And I'm opposed to violence and very much in favour of non-violent direct action. And that's what saved the Franklin. Mm. But it risked going out of our comfort zone. Environmental downfall on the planet is going to overtake everybody's comfort zone if we don't do something about it. So there you go. I want to, at the moment, the current prohibitions stop this, but be up with those people who have been peacefully protesting against Adani's gruesome and in terms of natural laws, criminal mine in central Queensland. I'm much closer to the oncoming logging season post-winter, where they're aiming to log more swift parrot habitat and spotted tail quoll habitat and Tasmanian devil habitat and white gorse habitat and Tasmanian wedge-tail eagle, you know, the biggest eagles in the nation, habitat, etc. And the question for me is, do I keep writing about this and doing interviews like this, or do I go and join those, that growing band of very wonderful and often very young people, that there's a great mixture of ages, who have decided to risk their well-being, their reputation, and go and sit in the way. Mm. And I'm very much in favour of doing that. I think that... otherwise, we just get caught by this process of politics fostered by sections of the media, which says, let's keep talking about this while the bulldozers and chainsaws are doing and coal furnaces are doing their worst.
Mm.
Time okay. for action.
Yeah.
there you go, so Paul. Much.
That was wonderful.
Great talking with you, and go well with it.
Thank you. And get down to the park hiding.
I sure will. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Fair Food Forager and Friends Show. I really hope you're getting a lot out of these podcasts. And if you have anyone that you think I should interview, please get in touch and let me know. Make sure that you leave some feedback on the Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and all those places. Rate and review the podcast. It helps it get shown by more people. Thank you, and I'll see you next time. Of course, you know it by now, but the tune at the start and finish of this podcast is by Ash Grunewald, and it's called 180. So thanks to Ash for that. And also Dana Ortner, who helped with the little intro at the start of this podcast and ran the original Fair Food Forager podcast. So thanks to Dana.